This episode of the Living Poetry Podcast was recorded on the 2nd of June, 2013, at the home of the Raleigh Review. My name is Bartholomew Barker, and I'm joined by the organizers of Living Poetry.
Tara Lindroth.
Angelica Teubel.
Pamela Taylor.
We've been reading about the Black Mountain School of Poetry. In 1933, Black Mountain College was founded in the town of Black Mountain, North Carolina. It was a very progressive school, even by today's standards, believing the study of art was essential for a good education. In 1950, the poet Charles Olson published his essay, Projective Verse, and the following year he was a visiting professor at Black Mountain College. This essay was considered the foundation for the Black Mountain poets. So let's start there. I was reading through this, and I like a lot of the ideas, because that's sort of how I write my poetry. You know, a line is a breath, and just, you know, trying to make the flow fit the, not worrying about form, but just, you know, the flow as though I were reading it out loud. But reading the essay, I couldn't understand what he was saying. I mean, some of it was just crazy. So, listen to this. The very beginning. He was talking about the kinetics of the thing, of the poem. A poem is energy transferred from where the poet got it. He will have several causations. By way of the poem itself, to, all the way over to, the reader, okay? Then the poem itself must, at all points, be a high-energy construct and, at all points, be an energy discharge. So, how is the poet to accomplish same energy? How is he, what is the process by which a poet gets in, at all points, energy, at least the equivalent of the energy which propelled him in the first place, yet an energy which is peculiar to verse alone and which will be obviously also different from the energy which the reader, because he is the third term, will take away. I mean, I feel like I'm reading something some crazy-eyed person gave me in a bus
term. Yeah, I had the same sort of in terms of what is this, but I attributed it to a poet writing an essay. I mean, if you read this paragraph, or if you listen to this paragraph, he writes it like we write poetry, mm-hmm. right? We insert fractions of a sentence because we want to initiate a pause on or a breath, right? And so if you take most of those out, actually things make sense. Like the how is he first, if you read it just fast, it doesn't make sense, right? But if you read how is he at all points energy, at least the equivalent of the energy which propelled him in the first place, then it makes sense. So there's a lot of superfluous stuff in it that equals techniques we use in poetry, at least today. Mm-hmm. I thought that article was also interesting, emphasizing process so much, as in allowing what comes out of you as being a good product. They do say you have to craft the language, but you have to trust, even if it doesn't have any structure, if it doesn't follow any particular, pattern in any form. I don't even want to say meter, because meter then makes us think of formal poetry. But any pattern is energy-written poetry. And he even says in this article that if it has to be colloquial language, then that's okay, because that's the way we talk. But if you talk to anybody else, we don't talk in a very eloquent way. When I tell a story, right, it's not very eloquent. There's lots of repetition that's unnecessary, emphasis at the wrong point. And that's why so many people praise poetry as being compressed language of the highest quality. And so he basically says the way we write is okay. So I thought that was interesting. And then he equates it to the page being a field of expression. Mm-hmm. You know, the other point I thought was interesting was that everything I've read about the school, and I've read a lot of administrative stuff, so managing the school, bringing it off the ground, as well as the development of the arts with regards to the other areas that a normal college would cover, everything is controversial. Everything you read three sources, and the three sources contradict each other. And so actually, the source, I have heard that even though projected verse is one of the key elements that people attribute to the Black Mountain College, mm-hmm. and particularly its literary branch, that basically nobody followed it who taught there at the time. They do credit it with having had huge influence on the poets that came after, but Creeley apparently didn't follow it. Duncan didn't follow it. So it's funny how something is being sort of a marker of that period of time and of an institution, but yet it wasn't what the people did that were actually at the college.
I thought it was interesting how they all came from different places and then they all seemed to move away again from there and were able to kind of plant their own little seeds around other parts, like when, you know, San Francisco and going there and New York and, you know, getting in touch with all of the different literary pockets that were going on at the time.
Yeah, what is interesting there too is poetry didn't really become big. I mean, it was there, but didn't become big until Olson joined it,
mm-hmm.
and eventually became rector. But so that's another interesting fact, right? So it was really only the last three to 4 years where literature became more important, because it was all about visual arts,
mm-hmm.
and textiles. And so only the last 4 years or so, and Creeley joined it, like, I think a year and a half, or Creeley joined it, I think, in physically moved from Spain to North Carolina in 1954, which is 3 years before,
right.
2 years
yeah.
before closure. But Duncan joined it only, like, for one or two semesters. So what I think is truly significant about this is that it generated so much energy, raw energy, in such a small period of time that it became significant in poetry, even though it was only 3 or 4 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, I have actually something I would like to read. There is an essay about Creeley in one of the books I have about the Black Mountain College experiment in art, and they say, what was it that Creeley found at Black Mountain that so attracted him? Creeley convincingly suggests that the answer may well be a group of highly volatile and articulate people in a rather extraordinary circumstance of isolation. People who matched and echo his own personal extremity. So it's that bringing together of people where their convictions and energy fly so high,
mm-hmm.
but is so unstructured.
Mm-hmm.
Which sparks, you know, so many new ideas.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they seem to have, so much freedom, even though they were so far from everything. But I get more of artistic freedom to do whatever they wanted. And I don't know if you came across what they, how they structure their curriculum, but you didn't have to go to class. You didn't have to take any certain classes to graduate. You just took a test, and if you happened to pass it before someone else, then
right,
you got
it
your degree.
Very much
it's about what you know. Yeah.
Well, it would all, it did depend on the faculty. So everybody
mm-hmm.
who came in there, there is a junior division and a senior division, and
mm-hmm.
everybody was a junior, no matter what they came in before. And
mm-hmm.
in interacting with the faculty is who moved you to the senior division, and the faculty who said you moved to the,
mm-hmm.
you know, you could graduate. But, like, whatever their criteria was didn't necessarily seem structured. You know, you didn't have to take,
mm-hmm.
you're right, you didn't have to take
mm-hmm.
certain level of classes. So in that way, it was interesting in that respect, that it was more, I don't know, it reminded me of like old Greek and Roman times. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, you
it's
get
more
to
about
a certain
art,
right? You get
yeah.
to a certain level of knowledge or way in your thinking, and then okay, we can move you to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
mm-hmm.
it was kind of that, and maybe that's why it was only 20 years in the making, because it's like, you know, that's it.
Yeah. So
let's talk about poetry now.
Well,
Robert Creeley's poems are the ones I like. wrote one, The Flower, very short. And it, I think he follows projective verse style. I think I grow tensions like flowers in a wood where nobody goes. Each wound is perfect and closes itself in a tiny, imperceptible blossom, making pain. Pain is a flower like that one, like this one, like that one, like this one.
I think his poetry is one of those prime examples that sounds better read out loud than if you just mm-hmm. read it quietly
mm-hmm.
Down the page.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way you just read it, you know, it actually sounded
mm-hmm.
like it made sense, right? But
yeah.
But that's one of the issues I have with Creeley, is like I cannot find myself into these poems. And so I kind of chop it off as this whole energy thing, you know, and then I'm like, okay, what kind of energy am I getting? But you reading it out loud is
mm-hmm.
actually quite a different experience.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I thought that was one of the things, going back to the projective verse, when he says it really starts with the syllable
mm-hmm.
and the sound. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the line that comes out of it, the head by way of the ear to the syllable, the heart by way of the breath to the line. So the sound in poetry being very important, more important than the form, which is sort of what they were struggling with or struggling against at the time that they were writing poetry. So it reminded me of the need to read poems aloud, because I think that particularly where we are, where we can like read stuff online, you don't necessarily hear a poem the same way when you're reading it silently in your mind versus reading it, one, out loud to yourself, or then hearing somebody else read it, right? I mean, because when we do critique, one of the things that we do is we have somebody else read the poem before the poet reads the poem, and so that way the poet can hear how the reader is hearing it. And so I think that's sort of comes out of this whole school of thought. One of the things that really struck me is, not that I didn't learn anything new, but a lot of it I had been familiar with, and I think it's because they influenced the people who, you know, I had advisors, and then my advisors, you know, teaching me in that same way. So it was like, yeah, okay, sound, okay, line, yeah, got it. But it was like the lineage of that, the far-reaching influence of it, I think, is now more ingrained in our aesthetic, you know, or in our poetics now. And so I think that's why a lot of it, you know, I expected to get some revelation, but it was like, no, this is just some of the same stuff that I've heard before
mm-hmm.
in a different way, and now it's probably been refined and refined and refined, but I think that's why, because it's sort of coming down from the people who
mm-hmm.
learn from them or from people like them
mm-hmm.
or who were influenced by them, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the section that Bart read out loud on projected verse, is it's all about transference of energy, right? And that's why we write poems that relate to the body, that where we can feel into the poem rather than think around the poem. And so it's certainly a tradition that we keep very much alive
mm-hmm.
As a way of connecting with the reader. Yeah, I have another poem that I liked. It maybe isn't so much on sounds, but I thought the Black Mountain poets are often likened to in concept and what they try to express to the self-reliance essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson and also by Thoreau Walden. Is that you trust that everything comes from inside you or is within you, and that it's more important to trust yourself as an individual, as a creative individual, than trying to strengthen, say, for example, your roots to tradition or to community or whatever else might influence as a person. And from that, I thought they tend to be very honest poets, and maybe, you know, the precursor to confessional poetry. And so I really like, it's a nasty poem, but I really liked it for its honesty. It's called Self-Portrait by Robert Greeley. He wants to be a brutal old man, an aggressive old man, as dull, as brutal as the emptiness around him. He doesn't want compromise, nor to be ever nice to anyone, just mean. And final in his brutal, his total rejection of it all. He tried the sweet, the gentle, the, oh, let's hold hands together, and it was awful, dull, brutally inconsequential. Now he'll stand on his own dwindling legs, his arms, his skin shrink daily, and he loves, but hates equally. And so I thought that I don't think that was written before that time, you know, to be so, mm-hmm. so on. To me, he writes, you know, he calls it self-portrait, but to me he writes about his shadow, right, about mm-hmm. the part, there's maybe a part in you that wants to be that way, but because of social restrictions or constraints, you hold it back. That, yes, to be openly writing something like that and publishing it, I thought was, takes courage.
I have one by Robert Creeley. It's a short one, and it's called The Warning. For love, I would split open your head and put a candle in behind the eyes. Love is dead in us if we forget the virtues of an amulet and quick surprise.
Very nice.
So I like
love that opening image.
Right? And that's mm-hmm. what I feel like what they were so focused on was, like, you know, stringing along these perceptions and creating one poem out of it, and that's in that short time he was able to bring in the image and then move you right along to the next one, and, you know, it pretty stealth, but
and I have the selected of Denise Levertov, who, if you read about it, she technically she never taught or attended the mm-hmm. college, but she was definitely associated with the people there. And in this collection of poems, it's Robert Creeley who's given the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but then she disclaimed her membership mm-hmm. from everything. Like, she didn't want to be associated with them. And
right.
Yeah.
It's, but mm-hmm. and but then when you read everything, then they always name her.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so interesting.
against her will.
Yes.
They must have wanted a lady in there.
Yeah. Before you start reading,
sure.
There was actually a section in a book I read that talked about, if you say Black Mountain Poetry or Black Mountain College, what does that really mean? And because they couldn't find really many common denominators, and I think this ties back to why Denise Levertov is listed when they talk about Black Mountain, is it says it can either be one of two things. One, loose set of friendships, or two, a vast range of aspirations in the arts. And I think the loose set of friendship is what Denise Levertov ties into the Black
mm-hmm.
Mountain poetry, because she was really close friends with Robert Duncan.
Mm-hmm.
And they
mm-hmm.
kind of got on rocky territory when she put politics into her, when she started
yeah.
to put politics into her poetry, and
mm-hmm.
that, because then it had a purpose, then it had that mental focus,
right,
right
mm-hmm.
which deviates from just putting the energy on the page,
right.
and that's
mm-hmm.
when there was sort of a split.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then I had read that the way that she was connected with them originally was her husband was friends with Robert Creeley, and so it was this,
mm-hmm.
oh, I gotta introduce you,
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah, and both she and Robert Creeley maintain correspondence with William
mm-hmm.
Carlos Williams. So
mm-hmm.
in some of the letters, you see references to one another
mm-hmm.
in their letters to
mm-hmm.
to Williams and
mm-hmm.
vice versa.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read two, they're short, but they're connected. The marriage and marriage, the marriage two. The marriage. You have my attention, which is a tenderness beyond what I may say. And I have your constancy to something beyond myself. The force of your commitment charges us. We live in the sweep of it, taking courage from one from the other. The marriage too. I want to speak to you. To whom else should I speak? It is you who make a world to speak of. In your warmth, the fruits ripen. All the apples and pears that grow on the south wall of my head. If you listen, it rains for them. Then they drink. If you speak in response, the seeds jump into the ground. Speak or be silent. Your silence will speak to me.
Mm-hmm. So why did you pick those two?
Well, I picked those two partly because I think they come from one of her, either her first or second collection, which, like I said, I'm reading the selected in conjunction with the letters that she did with correspondence between me and Carlos Williams, and in that, I think he, in the letters, he praises that collection, and so I was like, oh, were there any poems for that? But I just liked how that the poems were explicitly connected by the title, sort of like an extension of the relationship, and like the first one is more so, is a little bit balanced, and the other one is more so, mm-hmm. you know, your effect on me type of thing. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was different ways of looking at mm-hmm. the marriage from those perspectives.
Mm-hmm. I have a Denise Levertov poem that I particularly like the images in it, and you know, even though, like we were saying, how she kind of didn't want to be a part of it, but it seemed pretty inherent in how she's linking everything together in each stanza or couplet, or you know, as each idea comes about. This is Losing Track. Long after you have swung back away from me, I think you are still with me. You come in close to the shore on the tide and nudge me awake the way a boat adrift nudges the pier. Am I a pier, half in and half out of the water? And in the pleasure of that communion, I lose track. The moon I watch goes down, the tide swings you away before I know I'm alone again, long since, mud sucking at gray and black timbers of me, a light growth of green dreams drying. Yeah, it was all such simple colors and images. There was nothing elaborate about it, but then it had such strong detail at the same time. Which, like the first one that Bart read with the pain is a flower, like he could have named a flower and he didn't. He just left it because of all the different types of, you know, pain that are out there and more simplistic. And
I got one that she wrote called The Poem Unwritten. For weeks, the poem of your body, of my hands upon your body, stroking, sweeping, in the rite of worship, going their way of wonder down from neck pulse to breast hair to level belly to cock. For weeks, that poem, that prayer, unwritten. The poem unwritten, the act left in the mind undone. The years of a forest of giant stones, of fossil stumps, blocking the altar.
Wow.
I still don't know what I'm making of the ending.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it the altar of sacrifice,
yeah.
right? Or is
right.
it the altar of marriage?
That's
like,
right.
of union, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
very good
mm-hmm.
open ending.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything from Denise Levertov that you
no,
wanted to share?
No, I've only focused on the guys.
She didn't want to be part of this anyway.
Yeah.
yeah.
No, no.
Well, and speaking of guys, actually, so I'm always interjecting a little bit of Black Mountain history. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Olsen was an egomaniac. He was very authoritarian, which was counter to how the college was intended to be set up, and also brought a real macho guy kind of attitude to the college, which made it apparently really difficult for women to attend because they were looked down upon and treated, you know, like second-class citizens, which surprised me. But he was 6'7", right? So he wasn't just... He wasn't just a mind present, he was a physical presence as well.
And I have Robert Duncan that I chose one from him. And it's called, "Often I am permitted to return to a meadow. Often I am permitted to return to a meadow, as if it were a scene made up by the mind that is not mine, but is a made place. That is mine, it is so near to the heart. An eternal pasture folded in all thought, so that there is a hall therein, that is a made place created by light, where from the shadows that our forms fall, where from fall all architectures I am, I say are likenesses of the first beloved, whose flowers are flames lit to the lady. She it is, queen under the hill, whose hosts are a disturbance of words within words, that is a field folded. It is only a dream of the grass blowing east against the source of the sun in an hour before the sun's going down, whose secret we see in a children's game of ring around of roses told. Often I am permitted to return to a meadow, as if it were a given property of the mind that certain bounds hold against chaos, that is a place of first impression, everlasting omen of what is." I liked the repetition that he was doing throughout, just kind of selected and not, you know, it wasn't in every stanza, mm-hmm. but he was able to get a little bit more drama on some other parts while still retaining this image of this open landscape of possibility.
So who do you think the lady was?
It's capitalized in the poem, mm-hmm. and then when he refers to her as Queen Under the Hill, all of that is in caps as well, so I'm not sure if that's some type of reference to someone, if it is, you know, it's first beloved, which is also caps, so if it's some type of
some
Christian, yeah,
or
if it's like mm-hmm. a religious reference, mm-hmm. if someone's in, you know, if it's Mary in her shrine or something, but I'm not sure how he was going about that or what was going on in his life at that time.
I have another one by Duncan called Passage Over Water. "We have gone out in boats upon the sea at night, lost, and the vast waters close traps of fear about us. The boats are driven apart, and we are alone at last under the incalculable sky, listless, diseased with stars. Let the oars be idle, my love, and forget at this time our love like a knife between us, defining the boundaries that we can never cross nor destroy as we drift into the heart of our dream, cutting the silence slyly, the bitter rain in our mouths and the dark wound closed in behind us. Forget depth bombs, death and promises we made, gardens laid waste, and over the wastelands westward, the rooms where we had come together bombed. But even as we leave, your love turns back. I feel your absence like the ringing of bells silenced, and salt over your eyes and the scales of salt between us. Now you pass with ease into the destructive world. There is a dry crash of cement. The light fails, falls into the ruins of cities upon the distant shore, and within the indestructible night, I am alone."
I don't know Duncan very well, but it seems like I have also a poem by him, such as The Sickness of Many a Good Thing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like his poems tend to be a bit more on the darker side.
Yeah, and this one at the end, it was sort of the it evoked the imagery of Lot's wife, who turned into a pillar of salt. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. even as we leave, your love turns mm-hmm. back, and I feel your absence, like the ring of the bell sound, and salt over your eyes. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
going back to the bad stuff. So he's telling her, don't go back to the bad stuff. Mm-hmm.
Well, he had an interesting, I guess, upbringing. He was one whose mother died giving birth to him,
yes.
and then he was given up for adoption
mm-hmm.
and all this stuff. And, yeah, so kind of more unconventional compared with, like, kind of like the early years of the other poets that, you know, went to Harvard and studied in England and
right.
all different things, so...
Yeah, so this is apparently also a more well-known poem by him, by Robert Duncan, such as this of many a good thing. Was he then Adam of the burning way, hid away in the heat like wrath concealed in love's face? Or the seed, Ares in Eros, key and lock of what I was? I couldn't speak the releasing word, for into a dark matter he came and asked me to say what I could not say. I all the flame in me stopped against my tongue. My heart was a stone, a dumb me, a darkness that stood athwart his need for the enlightening, the I love you, that has only this one quick in time, this one start, when its moment is true. Such is the sickness of many a good thing, that now into my life from long ago, this refusing to say I love you has bound the weeping, the yielding, the yearning to be taken again into a knot, awaiting a string so taut it taunts the song, it resists the touch. It grows dark to draw down the lover's hand from its lightness to what's underground. Right, I love this. This poem spans, he doesn't quite say how much time it spans for the speaker, but you know that I love you could have been in teen years if you envision the opposite person being a lover. And how I envision the speaker now being older,
mm-hmm.
and how that still affects the way he reacts to lovers.
Mm.
I thought it was very touching.
Mm.
Very sad, though.
Isn't he talking about more of it at the very end? It seems like here's this surface thing, you know, that I could tell you to make you feel good, but, you know, now let's use that to get to something deeper, right? Isn't sort of how it ends?
Well, to me it's I don't know, it's the words he uses
mm-hmm.
don't give me the impression that he's finding a deeper richness under the surface. So he says that the I love you has bound the weeping, the yielding, the yearning to be taken again into a knot awaiting a string. So
mm-hmm.
to me there isn't anything, right? That's
well,
there.
Not awaiting a string is like the string that pulls, that opens up the knot, right?
Well, but, or tightens
it.
It tightens it.
Either way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It resists the touch. It grows
mm-hmm.
dark.
The college, while it closed up in, what, 1957 or so,
56, 57.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
around in there. Black Mountain is just to the east of Asheville on I-40.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Black Mountain College Museum in Asheville.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need a live-in poetry road trip.
Yes.
All right, yes.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to the Raleigh Review for granting us this recording space. That concludes this episode of the Living Poetry Podcast. Please visit our website, livingpoetry.net. If you have any comments or questions, please send an email to podcast@livingpoetry.net. This has been Bartholomew Barker,
Tara Lynn Graff,
Angelica Teubel,
and Pamela Taylor.
Living Poetry.